Blog Talk Radio.
Let that fade out. Good evening and live from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. This is Dr. John Stamey, and welcome to the world's best paranormal show, at least I think so. It is ScaryCast for a Monday night. We've got a great guest, we've got great panelists, and we're going to have a lot of fun. So I hope you listen, and listen good, as they say up in the mountains. All right, first of all, tonight I'm here, and we will introduce the Surgeon General of ScaryCast. One of my favorite people to talk to about the paranormal, the one and only, oh gosh, what's his name? Oh my Lord. I just had a moment, Dr. Trey Donaway. I forgot everything. I know you've never had those. Dr. Trey Donaway, how are you doing?
I get them more and more frequently, John, more and more frequently. I am happy to be here. And what an interesting topic tonight, meteorites. I'm looking forward to it very much.
Lots of stuff up in the sky, I'll tell you that. And the queen of ScaryCast, without whom we just wouldn't be the same, the one and only Robin McCray. How are you doing tonight, Robin?
I am doing great. Glad to hear everybody's voices tonight.
We're glad to hear yours, and thank you so much for being here. We appreciate you and Trey. And the other person that we appreciate a lot is from Houston, Texas, and he's coming up to watch me run an event this weekend. Might not be back, but I don't think so. I hope he's going to enjoy it. The one and only Kyler Smith. How you doing tonight, Kyler?
Yeah, it'll be a great time. But I'm just slowly recovering from a sickness over the weekend, but I didn't want to miss the show.
Well, what Kyler told me is he'd worked too hard for about 2 weeks, and his body started shutting down. And I think we all know about that. So we will not do that anymore, Kyler, okay? Doctor's orders.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Okay, well, it's great to have you here. Well, tonight, okay, here's the story. Last weekend, about 9 days ago, I was at the Grand Strand Comic-Con in Myrtle Beach. And I was there at my table, and I backed up to this gentleman and his son. And Robin, you know I'm always going to go talk to everybody, right?
Oh, definitely.
And so what happened is I started talking to his son. His son's an actor. He's in college. And then I looked, and I started talking to Craig. And I saw Craig had about 4, 5, 6 books on his thing. And I saw this one called Fireballs, and I think Craig and I started talking, and as I say about Robin, as I say about Kyler, and especially Dr. Trey Dunaway, we haven't stopped talking yet, have we, Craig?
No, we haven't. It's been an interesting 10 days or so.
And it's so good to have you on here. So I met him at a Comic-Con, which is kind of the fundamental basis for my entire life. And because I believe that the whole world is really a Comic-Con in some form or fashion. But anyway, Craig, first of all, tell us a little bit about yourself. I want everyone to know who you are and what you do. And then I'm going to start talking to you about your book. So first of all, tell us a little bit about Craig Hipkins from Dallas, North Carolina. And I used to date this girl from Dallas, North Carolina, and I never really liked her, but I liked her best friend. That's, you know, in college, I guess you can, Trey, in college you can do that, right?
Oh, yeah.
That's right. No qualms about it. I liked Lexi better than I did Lisa. But I think Lisa liked me a lot, and so it didn't work out. But anyway, I was up in Dallas, North Carolina, a number of times. No last names for Lisa. And anyway, it's just great to have you here, Craig. So tell us a little bit about you and your background, and why are you interested in cool stuff like fireballs?
Well, I appreciate it, John. And first, let me start off by saying that I live in Dallas, North Carolina, but originally I'm from Massachusetts. You can probably hear it in my accent, but
that's my home.
But, so I became interested. I've been interested in anything up in the sky, astronomy, the stars, planets, and UFOs. I've been interested in this stuff since back in the 1970s when I was growing up. And I heard about Tunguska in 1984. I was reading a magazine. For the life of me, I can't remember what the name of the magazine was. I think it was either National Geographic or Discover. It was one of those big magazines that was popular back in those days. Might have been Popular Science, but anyway, they had an article on the Tunguska event in there. And I think I was 14 or 15 at the time, and I just became fascinated with it. And because I was fascinated with astronomy, I'd never even heard of I'd never even heard of this before. So I just became fascinated with this stuff, and I've been dealing with it ever since. So,
well, that's great. Now, what do you do for a living, Craig?
So I'm a writer, okay, but I don't do that for a living. I work for the railroad. If I wrote for a living, I'd be starving. And I got to put my son through college, so... writing my books, I love doing it. It's more of a hobby. I make a little bit of money off it, but I work for the railroad. I work in the signal department. So that's what I do to
All right.
sort of put bread on the table.
Well, that's great. All right, now let me ask you, my first question is, tell us a cup other than Tunguska, which is absolutely fascinating to me. Tell us some of the stories other than Tunguska that you have in your book, Fireballs. I wish everybody would buy this book. I've read three chapters. I mean, that's about all I've had time to do, Craig, and I'm sorry, but it's a really cool book.
So I never thought about writing a book about anything really until 2007. And so I was out of my job one night. And I saw this fireball in the sky. It was green. And I mentioned it in the preface to my book, but it was a green fireball, and I had never seen a green fireball before. It was the first time I'd ever seen one. I got a Celestron telescope, a reflector, and I'm always out there looking up at the stars and the planets and stuff. And I've seen a lot of fireballs over the course of my 54 years, but I never saw one that was green until that time. That was in 2007. And what was strange about it is that it appeared, because it was extraterrestrial, but something shot off of it and went up, and that kind of fascinated me. So I did a little research, and I found out that in the 1950s, there was actually, I don't know if you've ever heard of this or not, but there was the thing, they called it the green fireball phenomenon out west, out in New Mexico. And so I did a lot of research on it, and there's actually a chapter in my book written on the green fireball episodes, but they don't know what they were. But there was a lot of them that were seen over the skies in New Mexico in the early 1950s. In fact, Life magazine had a story about it that they published in the, as a matter of fact, it was the issue that had Marilyn Monroe on the cover, and I actually have a copy of that magazine. But it's interesting because they don't really know what those green fireballs were, but they were seen out in New Mexico in the West. They think it could have been some sort of experiment that was going on because it was over. It was near Las Cruces. And
All right. Craig, I gotta interrupt you here.
Sure.
Every month, our paranormal expert from Roswell, New Mexico, John LeMay, comes on here.
Okay.
Is there any way that you can get me a PDF of that article from is it Life Magazine?
It's Life Magazine from 1952, and it's the one with Marilyn Monroe. I actually have a copy of it. I could probably send it to you.
If you could send me a PDF.
I could print it out and send it to you, or I could make it into a PDF and send it to you, either or.
Make it into a PDF, because I want to get that in the hands of John LeMay, because we're going to have him on here in a couple of weeks. He is on he's got a hall pass tonight. He has to go to Ruidoso, which is where he and I are going to actually be running the Flying Saucer Comic-Con. I mean, I just got to go ahead and call it what it is. We're going to be running the Flying Saucer Comic-Con out there next September. And I want to get this in his hands because he is truly – he's got a series of books with Noe Torres about UFOs from – he goes by decades or by two decades, and he's just a genius of a writer. He really is. He's a local television host in Roswell and just somebody I am thrilled that we know. So if you could get me a PDF of that, I want to get that into his hands as quickly as possible. I think it's important that he sees it, and he's out there, and he's in, Roswell, New Mexico, and I'd like to get his comments on it when we have him back on the show here in a couple of weeks. So, all right, I'll do that. Great, thank you.
I can't, and I just want to let everybody know that I do write about that in my book. I dedicate a whole chapter on the green fireball phenomena, and so if you're interested in reading it, it's in that. I did write about it in my book, so there's a whole chapter on it. But
that is chapter 9.
Say again,
I've got the book right in front of me.
That's right, chapter 9. That's it, chapter 9. Yep, and there's been different theories that have been proposed over the years. It was a skyhook balloon, just stuff that really didn't make any sense, that people threw out there. The government was throwing out there, and a lot of their interpretations of what they were just didn't make any sense to me anyway.
Craig, I'm going to stop you right now, and I'm going to ask Robin, do you get any kind of a vibe or anything about what the green fireballs were?
As far as why they were green, no. I completely believe where he said that he saw something leave from them. To me, that goes back to more of a UFO phenomena. And you're talking about, we already know that right now we are getting more ET and UFO activity than ever before in the history of our world. But even back when that happened, you're talking about an area that is well known for UFO activity. What it actually happened and it came down, I have no idea. I would really love to know the reasoning behind the green, because that doesn't even make any sense.
No, not at all. I mean, that's not one of the colors of rocket fuel or one of the colors of the rainbow that is associated with flames.
Well, we've had the UFOs that are here that have the multicolored lights. In fact, I've shown you the photos of them, and they've got the green and the red and the yellow and the blue all on one ship. I mean, it's just incredible. We've got a photo of one where it's spinning the multitude of colors around, and then we've got one where it's just separate colored lights all around this really odd-shaped craft. But for something that big to be just this neon green, to me that says it's got to have some kind of certain gas or material where it came into our Earth.
Green. So copper will burn green, and that's one theory that's been that it was something made out of a copper material, and I read that somewhere. But
that actually makes sense. The reason why I say
so
that is – I have a friend that lives out of, she doesn't live in the same state I do. And she has this one area of her property, and there are always UFO lights and UFO ships that go down there, and they're pulling minerals and metals out of the ground there. This has gone on for decades. And copper is one of the things that are very heavy and rich in the soil. So that doesn't surprise me.
Gotcha. There was there was an astronomer that, his name was Lincoln LaPaz, and he wrote a book called Space Nomads back in the 1950s, and he actually investigated these green fireballs, and he was convinced that they possibly could have had some sort of artificial origin, that they weren't, you know, they were man-made or some, you know, either some technological advance, or that they were even Russian made, something that the Russians were experimenting with.
Right.
That
all right. Hey.
Me.
All right, Craig. I'd like to give Kyler and Trey an opportunity to ask you a question, because I think this is a very interesting topic. Trey, do you have a question for Craig?
I just recently read, I don't remember where, it was an internet news source, so there you go, but that two new minerals were discovered in a very large meteorite that was recovered in, I think it was Somalia. They recovered the meteorite. It was like a 15-ton meteorite, and when they sliced it, they discovered two new minerals. So that's a meteorite that has been in the news in the last week or so. I thought that was pretty exciting. Then I found out that they had man-made that mineral, but it was discovered. But now, tell me if I'm wrong, but aren't most meteorites nickel-iron combinations? There are different varieties of meteorites, aren't there?
Most meteorites, there's really three kinds of meteorites. The most common is a stony meteorite, which is like it's a combination of like mostly rock, but it's I'd say about 80% of meteorites, stony meteorites, just rocks made up of different minerals. There's different sources, but I think about 10% of them are nickel iron. So nickel iron are the rare ones. There's a mixture. There's three types. There's a stony iron meteorite, and they're almost as rare, but most of them are stony meteorites.
And what type of material are the stony meteorites composed of?
It's just different minerals that they're like. You got chondrites. You got chondrites and let's see. I know there's in the nickel iron meteorites is an element called iridium. It's iridium, and it's like it's sort of a rare element. I think it's up around 77 or 80 or something like that up on the periodic table of elements. But it's found in a lot of meteorites. So
now,
isn't
there an iridium layer that has been found by paleontologists that they think is associated with the supposed meteor strike?
Yes.
Like
at the Cretaceous boundary.
Catastrophic
yes.
event in the Earth's
past. A catastrophic event, yes. They find that, and they associate that with meteorites. It would be in stony iron meteorites and nickel iron meteorites. You would find that element. But mostly, it would tell that there's probably a lot of nickel iron in it.
Well, I've always been fascinated.
Those are the three types of meteorites that typically are found. It's a different as far as elements go. Iridium's probably the telltale sign.
Uh huh.
Okay. Cool. That's a great answer. Robin, did you have a comment you'd like to make?
I was trying to think, and I'm probably wrong on this. Isn't that the meridian where once the light hits it, it makes it turn the neon green?
Now, that I don't know. I'm not sure if it turns, what color it turns, if light is hit on it. I do know that copper has a green, like when it burns, there's a green tinge to it, I guess you'd say. But I'm not sure what
it is. I had worked with somebody that had these pieces, and it was almost like a crystal, and they called it meridian. And I had, at that time, I knew nothing about it. And he was telling me that, you know, it's really hard to find, blah, blah, blah. But whenever we would hit the light on it, like it would look perfectly normal. But when you would put light on it, it would be like, it would illuminate this neon green.
That's interesting. I hadn't heard that.
But I could be wrong. It just made me remember it.
When I just
but
looked up
the ring, that's definitely the material.
Atomic number.
I'll say again.
Yes. Number 77, very hard, brittle, silvery white, transitional metal of the platinum group. Second densest.
Yeah, I knew it was up there in the 70s or 80s somewhere.
Right. So it's very, very dense. Corrosion and even at high temperatures. Doesn't say anything about green. It looks. Maybe if you do a flame test on it, you get something, but it doesn't mention anything about that.
Well, it'd be interesting if somebody did experiments on it to see.
Did John disappear?
Hello?
What happened?
I think
so. No, John
disappeared.
No, John, can you hear me? John just returned.
I hear you now.
Well, we can hear you.
Yeah. Sorry. I have these, you know how sometimes people have moments? Well, my internet connection sometimes has moments. I'm back. So anyway,
but you're
here
back.
We are. And
when you were gone, John, did you see any McRib sandwiches? I'm still looking for where they go. When they say McRib is back, where do they go? I thought maybe you had gone to where McRibs go.
Trey, okay. I tell that story everywhere, and everybody loves it. And they get confused. They'll say, well, where my surgeon wants to know, where did it go? And they can look at me.
Yeah, so it can come back.
I love it.
Okay. All right. I was just checking. Since you were gone for a while and then you came back, I thought maybe it was the same place, but evidently not.
No, I was actually trying to move my phone around and get a better. Anyway, so yeah, I'm back. Anyway, thanks. So anyway, that's good. Now, Kyler, you have a question like everybody else. You got a question for Craig?
I was thinking about when these meteors or meteorites come down, how are they addressed? Like, is anyone follow these and go pick them up, or are these immediately recovered by government and scientists and no one can touch them specifically they think it could be anything?
There is a database that you can report meteorite sightings to. I don't have the address. It's a web address, but you can report meteorite. And I'm gonna tell you right now, most meteors don't become meteorites. So most meteors burn up in the atmosphere. And you might look up at the sky and see a meteor, and it looks big, right? Well, it's really probably only the size of a pencil eraser, and but it never hits the ground. Most meteors never hit the ground and become a meteorite. So meteorite is actually when it hits the ground. So most of them don't hit the ground. I'm not sure what the percentage is on that, but it's very few. If you look at the meteor showers periodically, you get the Perseids and stuff. And you look at these showers, and most of those burn up in the atmosphere. So it's very rare that you actually have one that actually hits the ground and becomes a meteorite. But that being said, when they do hit the ground, it's a free-for-all because people actually, search for them. Sakhod Alin in Russia It's probably one of the most famous falls. It took place in 1947. I mean, it was a huge meteor that was seen over Russia. And there, people are still finding parts of that meteorite today. And you can actually go online. You can go to eBay and buy, you know, there's actually people that sell Code Eileen meteorite fragments. You can get them pretty cheap, $10-$15. But that was one of the biggest meteorite falls in recent times that where they've actually recovered debris. But there's been other ones. People, this meteorite hunters, they go out. That's what they do. They'll search areas. They'll search in the desert. They'll take the metal detectors out there and they'll look for meteorites. But like I said, most of them don't reach the ground. And if they do, it's whether, you know, if they land in your property, they're yours.
Hmm. I'm kind of surprised you said that, because I would have thought, like, anything coming from space whatsoever would be something of interest to specific people.
Well, if it was like a, if it was something like from Skylab or something like that, yeah. But if it's just a meteorite, it's interesting to people, and people want to see that stuff. But like I said, it's rare for them to hit the ground and become. I mean, there have been rare cases, though, and I write about it in my book. There's been rare cases where people have been struck and even killed by meteorites. There was one case, I can't remember the year, but I think it was in the 17th century. There were two Swedish sailors killed by a meteorite that fell on their ship. I mean, what are the chances of that, right?
Hmm, okay, well, so I guess then...
You just mentioned one in a couple thousand years, pretty small.
Yeah, I mean, most meteors are very small, and they burn up before they hit the ground. But the ones that do hit the ground... some of them can be, I mean, there's going to be a time where there's going to be a world killer event where there'll be a meteor. It'll be like the one that hit the end of the dinosaur 65 million years ago. I mean, it's a matter of time. It's probably not going to be in our lifetime, but it'll happen again. I mean, they're out there.
Well, they have a website for fireballs. They have fireballs.
Say again?
There's a website for fireballs. This is fireball.amsmeteors.org. And they have, in the last 30 days, there's been 6,502 reports.
Right.
All
over
the globe.
Them. I've actually reported some to them, to their database. So if you see one, any kind of, now if it's just like a meteor shower or something, and it's, you know, but if you see like a meteor that's like burning up in the atmosphere, which you can tell the difference between just a meteor, where I call a shooting star, in a meteor that's like a pretty big event. You report it. Yeah. So that gives them kind of a, they know because people report them from all from distant locations. Like the one I reported in 2007, that green fireball, it was reported. There were people in Kentucky that saw it. So it was a lot of people saw that thing. And they were able to calculate the location of where, you know, about approximately where it burned up. They don't know if any fragments hit the ground or not. But there was a couple of articles that were written about it. And there was one of them in the Charlotte Observer. But I don't think anybody ever found any fragments of it. But like I said, that one there, that was strange because a piece of it actually, from what I saw, flew upward, and meteors don't do that. Meteors, the only meteors that you would see that would fly upward would be what they call close contact meteors, which they kind of bounce off the atmosphere and go back. There was a famous one back in 1972 that happened. A lot of people saw it, and it just went back into outer space. It was used the gravitational field of the Earth, and it just went back into outer space. And it was due to the trajectory of the media. So it's interesting stuff. I could talk about this all day.
I understand one place people look for meteorites is either the polar regions because of the snow, they show up better on a white background, and that's one place where it's a lot easier to find it. It'd be very difficult to find it just wandering around. I guess with a metal detector, you could certainly increase the chances of finding it, but I understand that the Arctic areas or Antarctic areas, because on the snowfields, it's easier to spot a little small dark spot versus someplace with vegetation.
Yeah, it's good. Funny you say that, because I believe Robert Falcon Scott, in his expedition to Antarctica in 1910, I believe it was, basically it was a scientific expedition, and they had people down there looking for things like that. I recall reading, I read his journal.
If you were near an iron nickel one, it would you might get a little bit of deflection of a compass might create a detector of some sort. It might be easier to find.
That would definitely do it. Yes. Are most meteorite hunters, though, they use metal detectors, from what I gather. I've never actually went out there and hunted meteorites, but people I've talked to and, what I've read is, they and a lot of them like going to the desert regions.
Right.
Because they're easy access to them. So they go out there and they search for them. And some people make a pretty good living doing it.
Really? That's interesting. And I'm sure they do. And now Craig, this is Dr. John. I've got a weird question for you. What is the most that you have ever heard of a meteorite fragment going for on eBay or at auction?
Now that is an interesting question. I don't really know. I mean, I guess if you had most of the meteorites I've seen on there are like Sakodaline, and some of the other popular ones that have, over the years that people have put up this auction on there. But they're just fragments, but most of the big stones, they would go up, they'd go up for auction at like Sotheby's or something like that. I mean, you wouldn't see them on eBay, you'd have them, they go up for auction. I mean, there's some pretty big meteorites out there. I mean, big ones it was a farmer. There was one case, it was a farmer. I can't remember where it was. I think it was Australia. He was plowing his field and he found this massive rock, and he noticed it was like an iron. It was a nickel iron meteorite, and it was one of the biggest that was ever found. And that thing, I think it's in a museum now. They can get pretty. As far as like a price, though, that's a good question. I'd be interested in knowing what it is.
And I think I was in New York and at the Museum of Natural Sciences, and they had a collection of fairly large meteorites. They were, bigger than a foot in diameter. And I don't know how much they were selling, but right now on eBay, they've got one meteorite listed for $22,000, and $22,500 for a meteorite, iridium nugget, 6 ounces. It seems a little steep when you could find one for like $14 too. So who knows?
Yeah, there's people on there that they really carried away. Yeah,
Without for the characteristics of it, I wouldn't be shelling out a lot of money for something someone said was a meteorite.
Well, you would have to have some provenance for me to be shelling out some money for it. That's for sure.
Right.
But no, that's a good question, John. I mean, I wish I could say what the amount was that I've seen on there, but most of them I see are just fragments that people come up with, and then, most of the big ones are just, you might see them go up for auction on a auction house somewhere.
Yeah, right. No, and I think Trey said something about, you're looking upwards in the neighborhood of 25 grand, and then you said as low as like 10, 12, or $15. I mean, so there's a very wide range of how much these things are going for, and My question is the authenticity of these meteorites. I mean, you know, like you got some dude from Topeka, Kansas said, I got a meteorite from XYZ. Well, how do you know that that's legit? That's an interesting question.
Yeah, you'd have to have something with some provenance, and I wouldn't buy anything on, like, I mean, I've got one meteorite supposedly from Sakota Aline. I mean, it's got a certificate of authenticity. So, I mean, I'm pretty certain that it's actually genuine. But you got to watch out. There's a lot of people on there selling stuff that's not real. And you just have to watch out. But you can get meteorite fragments pretty cheap. I mean, small ones.
Well, you can get things that appear to be meteorite fragments. Okay,
That is true.
That's interesting. And even though we're at 9:36, I'm going to say thank you very much to the people at Transamerica Life Insurance Corporation for keeping us on the air. We appreciate you. It's a great company. And if you've got any questions, call me, Dr. John, at 843-655-8775, Transamerica Life Insurance, the company you can live with and otherwise. Anyway, all right, well, this is great. Okay, have you got one more favorite sighting, and then we're going to hit Tunguska hard, okay?
Okay. Throughout my book, I've got, not only do I have meteors that have, well, I'll just tell you what, I've got terrestrial meteors that people have seen, but one of the ones that fascinates me the most during my research was a meteorite that was seen in 675 AD. I'm going to say a meteorite because they never found any debris from it. So it's just a meteor. But the thing that interested me, it was seen over the town of Barking, which is outside of London. And it was recorded by the Venerable Bede. And I think, I'm not sure if Gregory of Tours, it must have been after him, but I'm pretty sure it was the Venerable Bede that recorded this sighting. But it was seen by a monastery, by a bunch of monks. It was in a cloister, a bunch of monks and nuns. They described it as it appeared like a light from heaven in a sheet, like a great sheet suddenly appeared and shone all over them. And they thought it was something from God. They assumed it was something from God. But the thing about this fireball was that it was strange in that it appeared to shoot upwards in the sky. And like I said earlier, you know, most meteors do not do that unless it's a meteor that's like a near miss or something. Most of them do not do that. Most of them they burn up in the atmosphere. It'll look like a candle just being snuffed out. You see the meteor, and it's there, and it's a blaze of glory, and then the next second it's gone. It's like a candle getting snuffed out, okay? But most of them are downward trajectory. The Barking fireball, it was not like that. It was like they described it as pieces of it going up, which to me seems to be something of intelligence. That there was some sort of intelligence behind this. Now, this is, remember, you got to remember the year. This is the year 675. So it was like, you know, there were no airplanes or dirigibles in 675, right? So, you know, you got to use your imagination here as to, you know, what this thing might have been. But that's just one that's always fascinated me. And there's a number of other fireball sightings that are kind of unexplained, that are just different. I mean, aerial phenomena like a fleet of ships doing battle in the sky. I mean, there were people that described that in medieval times. And you know, what that was, I mean, now some people say it could have been the Aurora Borealis. People didn't know what they were seeing. But most of the people that recorded these were monks. Because back in those days, the only people that really could write, read and write were monks, priests. The average Joe, you know, couldn't read or write back in those days. So, and monks and priests were pretty smart. I mean, yeah, a little superstitious, but they, they could pretty well tell by looking at something maybe what it was. But I'm sure, you know, a lot of them have seen meteors, but seeing stuff like, you know, just saying stuff like that, like seeing like armies fighting in the sky. It's just, you know, how do you, what was that? What did they see? What were they seeing? You know, we'll probably never know, but, you know, it could have been extraterrestrials, you know?
Okay. Well, I mean, absolutely. Okay. And now I've got to interject, this is Dr. John, one quick question before we get to Tungan stuff. Now, my
sure.
question is, of course, the Star of Bethlehem. And from what I've heard, that was a comet. Now, I'm not going to say whether it was a divinely placed comet or not, but I've heard it was a comet. What say you?
Okay. So I actually write a whole chapter about this. I believe it's chapter 13 or 14 in the book, but it's called Fireball of the Magi. And I'm not convinced, but I'm not convinced, but I'm almost certain, okay, that this, that what the Star of Bethlehem was not a star at all, okay? I think it was actually a meteor. And the meteorite, and I could get into this in depth, and we could talk about this for the whole, you know, the whole rest of the show if you want to do. But my theory is that the Star of Bethlehem is actually a meteorite, okay? And so that the Magi actually, well, coming from the east is what they said in the Bible. They said they were coming from the east, okay? And that they actually were heading toward the star. So the star, okay, they saw a star. They saw a shooting star, okay? So they followed that. Okay, but, you know, shooting stars only last for seconds, right? Or meteors, they only last for seconds. But they heard that the shooting star landed in a place called Bethlehem. So my thing is that it was actually a nickel iron meteorite. This is my theory now. I got absolutely no proof that this is actually, you know, what it was. But meteorites have been revered since ancient times. I mean, one of the Roman emperors, Elagabalus, actually worshipped the meteorite. In Mecca, there's the stone of the Kaaba is actually, they believe, because nobody can really get in there to do tests on it because it's a holy relic and it's revered. But they believe that that's a nickel iron meteorite. And there's a chance that that stone of the Kaaba is actually the Star of Bethlehem. That's another theory. So it's different, just different things. That's my theory anyway. The comet theory is another one that's a good theory too, but I prefer to believe in the meteorite.
Okay, well now let me ask you the corresponding question. Why do you not think it was a comet due to the time that it was seen? I mean, it seems to have been seen over about maybe 90 days.
Okay, so yeah, that's a good question, because comets usually, you know, this thing, they call them periodic comets, and they come at different intervals. So like Halley's Comet is a periodic comet. You know, it shows up there like every 75, 76 years or whatever it is. Comet Hale-Bopp, which came in 1997, was another one that's a periodic comet. I don't know if they know when it's coming back, but the timing, from what I can gather, the timing does not fit for it to be a periodic comet that is known. If you look at the timeline, okay, they know that Jesus died during the reign of, he was crucified during the reign of Tiberius, I believe, and I believe Tiberius was the emperor of Rome from like 14 to 28 AD or something like that. So he would have had to have been around 28 AD. And if you go back 32 years before that, you're back to about 4, 5, 6, you know, no more than 9 BC. Okay? And Halley's doesn't fit in that time period from the estimates that I've done. But it could have been another periodic comet. It's not saying just because that's not that I don't believe it is that that's not the case. I mean, it could be a comet. I choose to think that it was a meteorite.
Okay, well, that's interesting. All right, so now we're going to take a break for like 1 second and say thanks to you for being here. And what we want to do now is start talking about the major at hand, which is Tunguska. And I have discussed this with Robin, and it's a great topic. So start telling us about Tunguska, and then we'll take a break in about 10 minutes and let everybody ask a question and move on.
All right, let's do it. Tunguska, the Tunguska event occurred on June 30th, 1908. Now, the thing with this thing was, to this day, 114 years later, they don't know what it was. Now, there's been many different theories as to what happened, but let me describe to you what happened first before I get into the theories. What happened at Tunguska in 1908 was that there was a major explosion. And estimates have said that it was between – I've seen estimates saying that it was like 5 megatons. I've seen them all the way up to 50 megatons of TNT, that it was equivalent of that. Realistically, probably 25, 30 tons of TNT. That would be the equivalent of the explosion. But just to give you an idea how big that is, like Hiroshima was only 15 kilotons of TNT. That was like it would be the equivalent of 15 kilotons TNT. So if this was just say in the low end, it was 5 megatons. Okay, that's a massive explosion. Okay, and they don't to this day they don't know what caused it, but there's been many different theories. But they do know what happened. I do know that it leveled an area, a forest area, about almost 900 square miles. So it was like it was a huge area, almost the state of Rhode Island. Just think of that. I mean, if this thing had happened over a major city, or even at a different time of the day, if it had happened like a little later on in the day, because it happened around the 60th parallel. It could have destroyed a city like Oslo or Helsinki or any one of those cities that lies along that same, you know, latitude. So this was a massive explosion. And the thing about it is they don't know, they didn't really know about it for 20 years because it happened in such a remote area of Siberia. It was in they called it the Tunguska area. The Tunguska region is a river, and it's in a remote, very, you know, this is in a very remote area of the world. I mean, it's where Stalin had his, you know, gulags, you know, back in the 1950s. So, I mean, it's where he had his big labor camps and stuff like that of Siberia. And there's just nothing up there. I mean, the area is just like it's permafrost. In the summertime, there's mosquitoes. And this happened in June, so it would have been in its, you know, hottest time of the year. But they didn't know about it, except for the people that lived around it. There wasn't that many people that lived in that area. There was a trading post and a few farms. And there was definitely some eyewitness accounts that these people were just simple people. They were herders and farmers and, you know, they didn't know anything, you know, they weren't sure what happened. They actually thought it was the gods were mad at them. So, I mean, you're basically dealing with people that were still living in, the medieval times, living in this region. And They didn't really know what happened. They just know that there was a massive explosion. It came to the attention of the authorities 20 years later. It was like 1927. A Russian mineralogist by the name of Leonard Kulik actually did the first investigation into Tunguska. And they sent him out there with the purpose of finding out what happened. And actually they were pretty convinced it was a meteorite, so that there was they were going to find some fragments. And when they arrived at the region, Kulik was amazed at what he saw, because remember, this happened in 1908, and this was 19 years later, and he was there, and he could still see the damage from it. So this was, like I said, 850 square miles or 900 square miles of forest that was just wiped out. And the trees were leveled in what's like, they call it a radial pattern. So they were all facing outward from a center, from an explosion that looked like it happened in the center. And all the trees were in a radial pattern for miles and miles around. And they were just excited to find this, because they'd never seen anything like it in history. And another interesting thing about it was that what Kulik found was, and he found it at the center of this radial pattern where the trees were laid over. The trees were standing upright. So they concluded from that the meteor or whatever it was burst up in the atmosphere somewhere. And they now believe that it was like 5 miles up in the atmosphere, that whatever it was came down. And I'll go through the different theories as to what they think it was. But whatever exploded was actually up in the upper atmosphere. And that's how the trees at the bottom, right underneath the initial explosion, were upright in the clouds. The force of the explosion sent everything outright from it. So the bottom of it was like, and it was sort of like Hiroshima. After Hiroshima, the buildings at Ground Zero were upright. Everything else was leveled. Okay, but the buildings at Ground, and it was actually, and that's one of the theories. A fellow by the name of Semenov, he was a in the 1940s, he actually looked at Tunguska in Hiroshima, and he kind of concluded that, okay, this thing was very similar to Hiroshima, and it looks like it could have been something man-made that did this, that created this. And that's where my theory of, Nikola Tesla's involvement in this comes out. But now, whether it was Tesla or not is another thing, but I can get into that later. But the major theories that they came up with were, the first one was a meteor. Okay, there was a meteor that they made. It would have been a huge meteor. They estimated about 60, huge. It would have been about 65 meters, 65 to 70 meters in diameter. And just by doing the measurements, the problem with this theory is that they never found any fragments, and they never found an impact crater. Okay, so if fragments had hit, like with Sakhodolin in 1947, which was much smaller than Tunguska, they found meteorite fragments, and they found craters, crater activity. They didn't find anything at Tunguska, nothing like that. There was a lake that they found that they think that there was an impact crater, but that has been proven false. It was not. It was a place called Lake Checo, and they found a stump in the middle of it. And they said, okay, well, this can't be. The stump would have been obliterated if it was a meteorite. So something was growing here. So they disproved that theory. The next theory is a comet, that it could have been a comet. Now, that's an interesting theory, because a comet, and they didn't know really what made up a comet until they sent up a probe Halley's in 1986 when Halley's came by, and I actually remember that. Actually, you know, saw Halley's Comet through the school telescope. I was in high school at the time, but they set up a probe, and they found out that comets actually were basically composed of gas, water, and dust particles, and some rocks, okay? So if it was a comet, theory is that if it was a comet, that it would there would be no trace of it left. And it would have had to have been a small comet. You know, something like Halley's Comet would have been colossal destruction. So it would have had to have been a small comet if it was a comet. But that's a theory that it didn't. They never found any debris. And a comet would have disintegrated. And if it disintegrated up in the upper atmosphere, or, you know, 5 miles up in the atmosphere, then if, you know, most of it's water and ice, you wouldn't detect anything. Another theory is that it was a black hole. And that's a theory that I think is kind of ridiculous because, okay, well, actually, there's a theory that it was a mini black hole. And if it was a black hole, it would, of course, everybody's aware, you know, if we got caught in the event horizon of a black hole, we'd be, deatomized. But if it was a mini black hole, you know, maybe the size of a, you know, tip of your, a pencil eraser or something, there would have been, okay, it would have been an impact, but there also would have been an exit.
There's a lot of speculation as to what it was. In terms of real evidence, I'm thinking that the only thing that we have is the pattern of destruction of the forest, which looks like a nuclear blast.
It does look like a nuclear blast, and that is what Alexander Kosentoff said a few years ago. He said it looked just like Hiroshima.
I'm the dumb boy here. If it walks like a duck, quacks like a duck, and acts like a duck, it's a duck. So, I mean, you know, it sounds like a nuclear explosion, which could have been about the only thing that I can think of would be a UFO that blew up. Because, I mean, we know we've had problems with UFOs. I mean, look at Roswell. So, anyway, I tell you what, Craig, We're going to have you back because this is an extremely interesting conversation, and I would like to give our three panelists one last question for you. Are you okay with that?
Yes, it's fine.
Because we'll have you back within a month. I mean, this is really – it's really wonderful to talk to somebody that knows what they're doing, and this has been a lot of fun. I think there's been some advancement in terms of knowledge for everybody. So I'm going to start with the Queen of Scary Cast, then the Surgeon General, then with Kyler, and then I'll make some kind of comment and we'll sail off in the sunset. So Queen of Scary Cast, what do you have to say or any comments to Craig about Tunguska or anything we talked about tonight?
Well, Craig, and you may have already answered this, and my phone kept blinking in and out, so I might have missed it. Did they ever test for radioactive material at the base of these trees? Because it's very common in crop circles that they have that. That's a common thing. It's common with UFO activity. Like we've had, for whatever reason, and here it's common, but I have a spot in my front yard where my security camera had caught a UFO above it. And then the next morning I went out there and I have a completely round, disc-shaped circle. It's not very big. Inside of it, everything was flat, killed off all grass. Now nothing will grow there. Now, I didn't have any equipment to check for, like, radioactive material or anything.
Yeah.
But that is what's common. I had a friend that dealt with crop circles in Michigan, and he had one of his people that he worked with through MUFON did it in Montana. And that's all – every time they have these crop circles, it shows up.
So they did test for things, and they did find some iridium elements, but not an abundance of it would say that it was actually something of meteoric origin. But when you mentioned like the UFO or something that could have crashed, burned up in the atmosphere, and that's interesting because if it had been nuclear, it would have been, and if it was extraterrestrial coming from outer space, found any debris of anything, apparently they get at Roswell, but that's not to say that it didn't burn up and just didn't leave a trace.
Well, and the other thing too is I had read on the internet about it, where this gentleman was actually on his porch somewhere, and when this happened, and the heat from that actually just threw him right off his porch. He was blown back when this event happened. Now, I don't know how far away he was from it, and he said that his shirt just felt like it was on fire from the incredible amount of heat. Another thing that's very common with crop circles is it's almost like they're burned from the inside out. It's definitely a different kind of heat.
There were a lot of eyewitness accounts that E.L. Krenov, he actually wrote a book called Giant Meteorites. I actually sent a copy to John here to look through. But there's a lot of firsthand accounts in that book that have eyewitness testimony that as far as what they experience. And there was a man that actually experienced, being thrown off of his porch and with a heat-like wind. I could read it if I had it here. I could read it to you.
Well, and whatever this was, it has some time, and this is only my opinion, which means nothing. It has some kind of connection to the whole ET phenomena, because when I remote viewed that hole, underneath that hole, there are more tunnels and there are more things living under there. And then today I was talking to Pat, my husband, about it, and he had read an article where they had actually lowered down microphones down in that hole, and they could hear voices.
Well, that's kind of strange. Some of the things that there was descriptions of it, and they described it as like the sky splitting in two. So, some of the descriptions of this thing were just fascinating. But no, it's not out of the realm of possibility. It could have been something extraterrestrial. That's one of the theories that's floating out there.
I almost wonder if it wasn't a natural event and the ETs tried to intercede, because they've done that before. That's happened multiple times throughout history.
There's a lot of the reports talk about seismic rumblings, like subterranean rumblings. So that it could have been some geothermal event that could have been stopped or something. You got to remember this is the taiga, so it's permafrost, so there's probably big pockets of methane gas or whatever under there. So it could have been something like that. It's not out of the realm of possibility.
I think we lost John again.
No, John has just returned from the crib. I just don't know, Craig. Trey, you have cursed me to go to the land of the McRib. Okay.
I don't know. I don't know where they go.
Well, it's as Rob say, it's kind of like a portal, and you go in there, and there's nothing there but the smell of McRib. Okay.
The McRib portal. We ought to investigate that, John. McDonald's portal. Through the golden arch, you end up.
Yeah, it is. Absolutely, it is. We'll discuss that at another time. That sounds great. All right. So Robin, thank you. I'm going to say thank you for your question. I assume you got it answered. And Trey, do you have a question for our guests tonight?
Yes, I do. When I hear about the Leonid meteorite shower in the summer, and we go out, we live on a lake, and we go out in the middle of the lake and we lay on the deck of the pontoon boat and stare up into the sky, and we'll see some meteorites, we'll see some streaks and some shooting stars. But if you just pick a nice clear night without a moon and you decide you're going to go looking for meteors, what are the expert tips? Where should you look? Should you look at the very top of the sky? Should you look toward the horizon? Do you look for them to be coming one direction or another? What are your expert tips for people that just want to go out and see a meteorite?
So if people just want to go out and see a meteorite, it's probably a random event unless it's a shower. What a meteor shower is when the Earth, rotating around the sun, so in its orbit, it's actually crossing the path of a comet. So that basically
right.
what you're seeing is debris from a comet. So
right.
time to view meteors is during one of these showers. Any other meteors that are coming, or they'd be called rogue meteors. They would just be, you know, depending on how small they are, they're not even going to be detected. But so
right.
if you're actually just going to go out there and look up at the sky, they could be coming from any direction, unless you know where, like you mentioned, the Leonids, you know, in the summer.
And then,
you know,
then they say look moving from one direction to another, and you can pretty much look for that. But just randomly,
it, so they
could be anywhere.
Right, and you're gonna see them in the constellation like Leo. Okay, you're gonna go up there, you're gonna look, and you're gonna see them. They're gonna be all coming from that area, or coming from that area, that region of the sky. So, but just a random, if you're just out there in your lawn chair looking up at the sky, and it's not a meteor shower, so you're not really, you might chance on seeing something. I mean, I've seen them before. Like I saw that green fireball. But and that wasn't part of a meteor shower or anything. So
so it could be anywhere in the sky, be coming from any direction.
Yeah.
No, there's no higher percentage when you're looking to do any one thing or another.
No, but I've always found it. I've mostly seen them probably midway up, not as high in the sky, but midway up. I don't know what kind of scientific say that is.
So
if
straight up
it's
90 degrees,
so
it would be 40-ish or so?
Probably about that. Yeah, that makes sense.
Okay. Well, the next time we have a beautiful clear night, I'll be thinking about you when I see a shooting star.
Well, that's good.
All right. Trey, that's great. And Kyler, what is your last word of the night and question for Craig?
Well, I was thinking about, like, when you were talking about the hunters, that everybody goes after these meteorites. And I'm thinking, you know, if I saw something like that, how would you even know where to start? Because I can't imagine that how far of a distance you'd have to go to travel and find something like that. I know you're not a hunter yourself, but, I mean, do you know of any way that they do that?
Yeah.
That seems like it would be kind of difficult.
Yeah, it is kind of difficult, but there's a lot of places that you can look, like, and I know a lot of these things are like on private land. Like, you probably heard of the Meteor Crater, the Barringer Crater out in Arizona. I don't know if you've ever seen it or not, but it's a massive crater out in the desert. And there's actually stuff, okay, when the rock is heated up to a certain extent, they create these rocks called tektites. And there's a lot. You can find fragments around known impact sites. But other than that, meteors have landed. I mean, you might find something in a something that landed in the 20,000-30,000 years ago. I mean, the only witness was a Australopithecus man or something, you know. And it's been sitting in the ground for that long. But you know, you find it with a metal detector or whatever. But there's really no, like I said, a lot of people go to the desert because that's an easy place to look.
Okay.
All right. Well, great. And look, I want to thank everybody. We've had a lot of fun tonight with you, Craig. It's been great. You've answered a lot of questions for us. Our panel has been absolutely spectacular. Dr. Trey Dunaway, Robin McCray, and Kyler Smith, you guys are the best. And, Craig, we're going to have you back by the end of January. It's going to be a lot of fun. I love this topic, and just the more we know about it, we'll have some discussions. So we'll see what we can come up with. So I want to say thanks to everybody. We've had a marvelous time here on ScaryCast. We'll be back next week, same bat time, same bat channel. So everybody say goodbye, and we'll see you next time.
Take care, everyone. Oh. Great to meet you, Craig.
Thanks for having me.
Bye.
Thanks for having me. Bye.